Thank you so much, Mike, for inviting me and for to the organizers for putting together a really, really fun and interesting week. I really have enjoyed this model of coming and hanging out in a comfortable space with our own offices to get work done, but also chat a lot, and it's really been very, very educational for me. So the title of my talk today is Population versus Synchronization Vector Codes for Space, Theory and Evidence. I'll talk about some theory and modeling work, as well as some published and unpublished data from the lab. And I would describe, on the broadest scale, my research interest as being in sort of neural coding. And I like to define neural coding as the process by which states of the brain, by which states of the world are mapped onto states of the brain. And here we're talking about spatial coding. So we can imagine a coding function, a neural coding function, which is a sort of a mapping from a finite domain of spatial locations that an animal can occupy in its world onto some set of brain states that it can encode those locations. That's the kind of spatial coding function that we'll be talking about. And I'm going to draw a distinction between two different kinds of brain states that can encode information about space. One is a population vector, which is a notion that I think is familiar to most everybody here. Simply the idea that information can be stored by patterns of neural firing, and in the case of representing space, it will be patterns of neural firing among spatially tuned neurons, so that each pattern of firing among a set of spatially tuned neurons will encode some specific location in space, perhaps uniquely. And then the other kind of brain state that I'll discuss distinguish from that is what I'll call a synchronization vector, and I'm not wedded to this terminology. If anybody has some suggestions for something else to call this during the course of the talk, or if it already has a name from existing theory, let me know. But what I mean when I say synchronization vector is a representational space in which the dimensions are not firing rates of neurons, but phase offsets between pairs of neural oscillators. And what I mean by that will become more clear as we go along, but this is the kind of coding scheme that is essentially used in these oscillatory interference models that we've heard about from Neil and Mike Castelmo and others this week. So before diving into this, I want to sort of lay out three constraints to think about. So from an evolutionary perspective, if we're going to build a code that represents locations in space and store it in the brain, we can think about what kinds of constraints and properties would be advantageous for this code to have. And I'm going to lay out three constraints that all start with C: capacity, continuity, and cost. I'll flesh out what I mean by these as we go along. But by capacity, what I mean is that you want to sort of maximize, once we've created a representational space in which we're going to store information about locations, we would like to use up as much of that space as possible to actually store information about space and not leave any of it on the table, not leave wasted states that don't really encode anything. So that's loosely what I mean by capacity. By continuity, I mean that if we're going to be using this code to solve spatial problems that involve, you know, geometry and so forth, it may be very useful for the code to have the property of continuity, meaning that states that are near one another in physical space in the world should map onto states of the brain that are similar to one another as well by some reasonable distance metric that will depend somewhat on the topology of the space, the representational space that we're using. And finally, I'll talk about a constraint called cost, which simply means that all of these things being equal, when we actually build the neural circuits that are going to store this code, we would like them to consume as few resources and as little energy as possible in their functioning so that they can be efficient and efficient, do their job well and efficiently. So,
can I start giving you
yes.
your heart?
Yes. Maybe it was you.
So, this last definition of cost, I have a little bit of concerns about, because it's not a metabolic or an energy cost, it's just number of resources cost that you're thinking of.
Well, no, it's all of that together. And it's very loosely defined as of now, but all of that together.
That restricted definition to number of items, number of neurons, number of synapses could conspire against robustness. So you could come with a very compact representation which would satisfy your cost requirement.
Okay.
That would not be a robust.
I think the point that you're making, which is well taken, is that whatever cost, if we're, I'm not going to lay up a formal cost measurement, but
okay.
we should definitely assume that a good cost measure should be normalized by performance.
Okay.
That I totally agree with that. That anytime we assess cost, we have to normalize by performance, and that will come up actually as we go along. So, any other questions about that? Yes.
So the two other constraints. So why do you need the code is almost completely used?
Well, you don't necessarily need that, but once you've allocated resources, physical resources to store something, then squeezing the most that you can out of it is I'm just saying all other things being equal, a reasonable thing to do. It's sort of like, if I've got 4 gigabytes of RAM on my computer, I don't want a processor that can only address 1 gigabyte of it. It's kind of that principle.
No, sometimes you actually do the opposite. Suppose you have a library and you get books and you want to put them there, but you don't have time to, put them in. If it's almost completely filled, you have to go through everything and find the one spot that is not filled.
Well, what you're pointing out, and I think this is I meant to emphasize this, and I don't know that I did yet, is that so capacity and continuity and are sort of competing constraints, and searchability, for example, are competing constraints. So, and I'll talk about how these things trade off. So. Very often, if you want your code to have more capacity, you have to give up some of the continuity, or vice versa, and you also have to give up, say, searchability. So there's a cost to increasing the capacity. So I think what you're pointing out, which is a point very well taken, is that these constraints often compete with one another and have to be balanced with one another. And I don't mean this to be an exhaustive list either by any means. I think what you're mentioning, like searchability, is a good point. Yes.
But high dimensions doesn't continuity is completely store capacity.
Well, that's very much an issue we're going to be talking about. So hold that thought. Yes, and the broad point that I'm making here at the outset is simply that by thinking about the fact that natural selection probably has to balance these constraints in some reasonable way, that approach may help us to understand the solution that nature has converged upon. Why the spatial code actually ends up looking as it does. Why we have these spatially tuned neurons like place cells, grid cells that encode space on multiple scales, boundary cells, head direction cells, and potentially these theta cells that are rhythmically modulated and lack spatial tuning, which I'll be interested in as we move along. That rather than bickering over whether oscillatory interference models or attractor models or what have you are more realistic, let's think about what the constraints are that would shape the code and how different possible solutions might satisfy real world constraints on the code. So that's kind of the approach that I'm hoping to take.
Is there any evidence that evolution has converged?
We leave them till the end. I want to hear the end of the talk. It's a serious thing, but it could take the whole rest of the 1.5 hours.
Come back in 10,000 years and we'll find
nothing
out.
Nothing else happens ever? What do you mean?
No. But I mean, when you write that,
let's discuss it later.
Okay, we'll move forward.
Forward.
That was my introduction.
What?
And here's the outline of my talk.
Evolution hasn't finished.
So this is going to be the outline of the talk following that introduction. One, I'm going to define sort of more clearly what I mean by these synchronization vector codes. Then I'm going to talk about some experimental evidence that they actually may exist and if they're going on. And then finally, some models that incorporate both population and synchronization vector coding. So a good place to start here is with the simple example of a grid cell on a linear track. You can imagine this is some figure data from this paper from the Moser lab, one of their supplementary figures. It's just showing that as a rat runs across a linear track, you have spatially periodic firing at regularly spaced intervals along the track, and the interval between each firing location we can call lambda, and as we know, that varies modularly along the dorsiventral axis of the ventral cortex. The inverse of lambda is the spatial frequency of the grid cell, and if we want to model this, a very simple model up for it would be something like this ring attractor model, which is essentially a very simple attractor model for spatially tuned grid cells on a linear track. We can imagine that as the rat is running across a track, the bump goes around this ring at a speed that is proportional to the rat's running speed. And so every time the rat travels a distance lambda, the bump is going to make one revolution of the ring. And so essentially the angular frequency of the bump is proportional to the animal's running speed with a slope determined by the spatial frequency. And this is an example of, so this is important now. So if we want to, we can integrate this frequency equation to express the phase of the bump, which is its angular position. And notice that we then, when we do that, we end up with this boundary condition. We're measuring, here we're saying that the phase of the bump with respect to some arbitrary reference point on the ring, this thing can be anywhere, but it's a fixed reference point in the ring with respect to which we're measuring the bump's position in order to decode the rat's position. And we can decode the position just by solving this equation for x, and we get that the position of the rat is how far is the bump displaced from this reference point. And that gives us the rat's position within this interval lambda on the track. Now, the reason why this is important is because the thing that's going to distinguish a population code from a synchronization vector code is this, the reference point. The reference frame in which we measure the bump position is going to be the defining characteristic of a population versus a synchronization vector code. So hold that in mind. Srinivasan and Feet have, Feet, is it supposed, is it Feet? Is that how it's pronounced? Feet? Okay. Srinivasan and Feet referred to this kind of a code, this sort of very straightforward population code, as a classical population code. And in this kind of a code, you just have a one-to-one mapping from locations in space onto firing rate vectors. And the capacity of this code is rather poor in the sense that I defined it earlier, insofar as there's only a very, very limited set of possible firing rate vectors that actually encode information in this network, right? The only bump-shaped states of the network encode positions, and there's many, many other sort of random firing rate patterns in this network that would just not encode any kind of position at all. They would not be interpretable as a position. And so the vast majority of the coding space that we've created, if there are m times n neurons, and the reason I'm expressing that as a product will become clear later, if there are m times n neurons in this network, then we have an m times n dimensional firing rate space, and most of the points in that space are not encoding any location whatsoever. The points that do encode locations lie on a circular manifold in the firing rate space that correspond to these states of the bump being in different positions. This is assuming the bump has a fixed width for simplicity. And so as the rat runs across this interval of length lambda, the state of the system traverses this circular manifold in the firing rate space. So even though this code lacks good capacity, it has very good continuity because nearby positions in the world or on the track here map to nearby positions in the representational space. So the classical population code sort of has good capacity, but poor capacity, but good continuity. Yes.
Why did you need the continuity in the first place?
Well, that's a good question. That's going to come up later. This kind of gets into this question of path integration and what is it good for. But whether you need that or not depends, I think, upon what kinds of problems you're trying to solve. So, I mean, an example would be, let me not go there for now. I think this is more of a discussion question, but I'm just taking it as a given that if we're going to be solving navigational problems that involve planning trajectories in a geometrically continuous space, that a code that is also that preserves continuity to some degree will make it easier to solve certain computational problems than if the code was so scattered in the representational space that we no longer knew what states were near each other anymore. That's an assumption for now. So the CPC code, the CPC code as Srinivasan and Pete called it, has poor storage capacity but good continuity. And another third thing that I'll mention is that noise can cause only one kind of error in this system, and that is, by noise I mean, well, so the attractor dynamics can train the system so that only bump-shaped states can exist, but the bump might not be in the right spot. So that's what we would call a positional error. It's or a path integration error if this thing is doing path integration. So there's one kind of error that we have to worry about in this system. So to increase the capacity of a population code, one thing we can do is to convert it from a classical population code into what the Srinivasan and Pete called a grid population code. So without changing the number of neurons, we're still going to have m times n neurons, but now we're going to split them up into n modules consisting of m cells each, or n rings. And I call them modules because each one of them will now sort of correspond to a grid module in the rat brain with a different spacing. And so we're going to just have the bump in each ring is going to depend on velocity with a different slope, so that as the rat runs, the rings will circulate at different rates, and we'll get so each ring will be composed from grid cells with different spacings and will essentially be a different grid module. Does that make sense? So far so good? So here, when we have more than one ring, we can imagine the bump position in each ring as sort of being the one circular dimension of a torus. So the states of this network will sort of lie upon the surface of an n torus, where n is the number of rings or the number of modules. And something that has been pointed out and studied is that this combinatorial code can rather vastly increase the capacity of the code, because it allows us to use up more of the space that we have created, the firing rate space that we have created with these m times n neurons. Now, rather than being confined to this circular manifold, we have the whole surface of this n torus to work with in terms of states that can encode information. And so we can encode much longer intervals of the track, and we can use many more of the states that are in the space.
Just to understand, the reason why that was not an efficient code was that you only have bumps of activity.
That's right.
You still here have bumps of activity.
That's right.
But it's just moving into, you have two-dimensional, so you are still using the same fraction of the...
The trajectory that this thing follows before it repeats itself is now the least common multiple of these two lambdas. So we've got a larger trajectory in the state space that's physically longer than that original circular manifold. That's number one. And number two, by using different boundary conditions, we can actually start the network in a different state, and then we can encode different environments with different regions of the space, if that makes sense.
If you take a snapshot before you have m times n neurons all in one ring attractor, and if you took a snapshot, there was only one bump. Now you have put n neurons into m rings. So if I take a snapshot, I have m bumps. I have a different bump in a different location in each one of those rings.
Yeah, but your phase space has also increased itself.
No, it's the same number of m times n neurons. They have just been separated. Instead of having one long ring of m times n neurons, you have m rings of n neurons each. So if you believe that each neuron can be firing or not firing, your state space is still 2 to the m plus n.
The range of positions that this code can represent is much, much larger than that of a single ring. And on that range, the response is not a single bump. It's now like a grid cell because it's periodic.
Right. Mm-hmm. You could think that
these papers sort of describe this pretty clearly, right? I think these are good references for going into that. So other questions? Okay. So we've bought more capacity by splitting up the rings from one into multiple, but we have compromised the continuity of the code somewhat, because now it's possible for a new kind of error to occur. So basically, we can imagine, for example, that if we hold this bump still while letting this one turn, that traces a continuous trajectory in our coding space, but that trajectory cannot be decoded as any sensible continuous trajectory in physical space. So this is a compromised but not completely destroyed continuity that we've had to pay for the increased capacity with a bit of a loss in continuity. And so the nature of that is that the forward mapping from every two points in physical space that are near to one another will still always map to points that are near to one another in the coding space. But the reverse is no longer true. There can be points that are near to one another in the coding space that now map back to very distant points in physical space, and that creates the possibility for these what I'll call teleportation errors to occur. Small shifts in the phase can cause huge jumps in the decoded position, and the Srinivasan and Fee paper sort of argue that that might actually be a good thing, a blessing rather than a curse, because the fact that these small phase errors can lead to large position errors might make the small phase errors easier to detect and therefore easier to correct. And so I'm not going to go through that whole argument, but yes.
Wasn't that true in the first case? You were suddenly teleporting from the end of the track to the beginning of the track?
Yes, that's true. But so within, but since this is a periodic representation, within the finite interval that you're representing, you still have continuity, but yes, that's right. Okay. So, now I'm going to talk about making another modification to this code, and this is where the synchronization stuff comes in, okay? So a property of this GPC code that we've discussed is that in every ring, when the rat sits still, as he's doing in this picture, the bump has to sit still. And when the rat runs in one direction along the track, the bump has to move in around the ring in one direction, the positive angular frequency direction. When the rat turns around and goes in the other direction across the track, the bump has to go in the other direction around the ring. So the y-intercept of the angular frequency function is zero, because at zero velocity, the bump, the angular velocity of the bumps goes to zero. And to create this synchronization code that I'm going to talk about, we're going to change that y-intercept. We're going to say that when the rat is sitting still, the bumps are not sitting still. They are moving. So here is a picture of that. The rat is sitting still, but the bumps are moving. And if we try to read this out as a population vector code or as a grid a GPC code, we're going to get, you know, teleportation errors is nonsense. So this is telling us that the rat is moving at three different velocities at once, which is impossible. So we're not going to read the code out that way anymore. We're going to measure the positions of the bumps in a new reference frame, which is respect to each other rather than respect to this static phase reference in the ring. Now, the other thing that needs to be pointed out is that these cells in the rings are no longer going to behave like grid cells. They're no longer going to be spatially tuned at all, because as you can see, the rat is sitting still, but every neuron in every ring is firing, rhythmically bursting at some frequency, which is the frequency at which this thing is moving around. So these neurons are behaving somewhat like the way theta cells in a rodent brain behave. They're bursting rhythmically at some frequency, and even and they do this all the time at all locations. Every cell fires at every location. It's not, there's no longer spatial tuning of the cells that store this code. What's that?
Does the repetition frequency have any speed dependence?
Yes, so that's what I'll show. I'll show that in just a second. Yes, it must. It has to. So all we've done is change the y-intercept, but not the slopes. So the speed dependence is still the same as it was before, basically. Does that make sense? We've just shifted these velocity functions upward. So so yeah, this shows what happens when the rat is running, is that now these things are all moving at different speeds. So just as the rat is changing his position in the environment, the bumps are changing their position with respect to one another, which is the reference frame in which we are now coding position. So that's the answer to your question. Does that make sense? So each bump is moving at a different speed when the rat is moving, as opposed to when he's still. They all converge to this common y-intercept. For now, that's what we're going to assume. And so really what we're doing here is not very different from what we were doing with the GPC code. It is exactly the same kind of a code, except that now the circular dimensions of our toroidal state space are no longer represented by the positions of bumps in their rings. They're represented by the difference between the position of the bump in pairs of rings. Does that make sense? But the structure of the as long as we ignore the coding space is still this n torus. It's actually n minus 1 now, because now there's the number of degrees of freedom is one less than the number of rings, as opposed to equal to the number of rings as before. But it's the same, essentially it's the same code that we had previously. It's just that we're now encoding these phase dimensions as phase differences rather than absolute phases of the bumps. So we're really using the same code in both cases in some sense, except that the state space in which we are representing this torus is a space of absolute phases in the GPC code, and a space of phase differences between bump pairs in this other space. And so here's the equation that I should put up before for decoding position from phase in a population code. We compare the bump phase against a static reference point in a specific ring. The equation for decoding a synchronization code is we compare an alignment between a pair of bump phases with a reference alignment between that pair of bump phases. Otherwise, everything, the equations essentially have the same form. Make sense? So now the question is, why would you prefer one of these ways of doing the same thing over the other? One of these two ways of doing essentially the same thing over the other.
Can you just go back? I didn't see the equation
at the bottom right there.
Yeah.
What's D?
Sorry, I should have defined. So D is the difference between the slopes of the
Two
rings. Yeah. I'm using, this is probably confusing, and I probably should use a different notation, but I use these little tildes to basically mean delta.
Okay.
So
Dij is Di minus Dj. So yes. You're getting a geometric, it's a mean of the 1 over lambda.
That's right. Yes. Another question? Yes.
How is this different from shape itself having a different xy shift? Because, so all this is saying is that they're measured relative, their phases measured relative to each other. Mm-hmm. And on a 1D track, if you assume that the grid locations are shifted with respect to each other, this is kind of reproducing that.
Well, yeah, but so it's, again, I mean, let's think about if we were to record from these neurons, it's a fundamentally different storage mechanism, because with grid cells, you're storing the code with neurons that are spatially tuned that fire specific locations. With this code, you're storing position with neurons that are not spatially tuned. So one way of putting this is that the mapping into firing rate space is 1-to-1 for a population code, but it's 1-to-many for this code. Okay? Does that make sense? So it's doing the same thing, but in a fundamentally different way, in a different representational space. It's using a different representational space to come up with the code with essentially the same formal structure, if that makes sense. So why would we do this? Why would we want to use one of these codes or the other? And I'm going to make an argument, and we'll see if this makes sense or not, that one possible answer has to do with that third constraint that I talked about, which is the cost constraint. How much does it cost to build, if we're getting out of the business of actually getting out neurons and synapses and building a circuit to do this, which one is less costly and more in terms of neuron synapses and energy? And I'm going to argue that it may well be that the synchronization code is cheaper because, and I'm going to argue that, so. One thing that happens when we shift this y-intercept upward is that the x-intercept moves off of the origin. In other words, as long as the rat's running speed stays on one side of this x-intercept, the bump never changes direction. And I'm going to argue that that is why this is a good code. That's the first thing that can help us understand why this is good, because it's actually expensive to build, more expensive to build a ring attractor in which the bump has to be able to move in both directions and sit still than it is to build a ring attractor in which the bump only has to move in one direction ever.
Mm-hmm. But hold on, let me.
Yes? Go ahead.
The whole grid cell is basically like a situation where the bumps, it's this thing is sitting in zero. So the grid cell system already exists.
Say that again?
the grid cell system already exists.
Yeah.
Right? And that's exactly the curve where that thing sits at zero.
Right.
So it's there.
It's there, but the question is, does its movement, and you're right, it's there, and it moves in both directions. But the question is the mechanism by which it moves in those directions, one of these like sheet attractor mechanism, which is extremely expensive, I will argue, in terms of neurosynapses, or is it inheriting that bidirectional movement from a much cheaper path integration mechanism? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's a little bit different. So, it's a little bit different when you first said it. We already have a system that's there, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So you're proposing another system to move that around?
Well, right now I'm just sort of defining the synchronization vector coding scheme. I am going to return to the question of how population and synchronization vectors coexist and work with each other, which I think is sort of what you're getting to. Because I'm not saying there's no population code. Of course there is. That's there. You're right. The grid cells are there. The question is, what job is each of those components doing? And this job of path integrating, the job of integrating velocity to compute position, is a job that some component of the system is potentially thought to perform. And I'm arguing that if you give that job to a network that stores the code as a synchronization vector, that job is done much more cheaply. You get a much better rate on that labor than if you give that job to the part of the network that's storing the population code. Does that make sense?
No.
Okay. Well, maybe it will later, yes.
So why is it much more useful? So in the previous instance, you had to reverse at zero,
mm-hmm.
depending on whether you were having a positive or a negative velocity.
Yeah.
Here I have to reverse when I go from minus 25 to minus 27.
Right. So that's what the point of this is. That's what the point of this is.
Increases and you know from 25 to 27.
No, that's right. So that's what the point of this is to show that you're absolutely right. So. The higher this y-intercept is, the farther away this goes, and the object of the game is going to keep this x-intercept out farther out than the rat can actually run.
So you can say, okay, that's the speed of light.
Well, now wait.
But now the cost is if you move that intercept, you're also going to move that intercept because your slope is fixed by the v over lambda.
That's right. You're going to move
and
the y-intercept.
That means
yes.
that now, and that intercept is the intrinsic omega, the frequency at which we're going around when v is equal to zero.
That's right.
So now the animal is doing nothing, and all these oscillators have to run at an incredible speed.
No. So this
has to be metabolically expensive.
When v is zero, this intercept can be nearby because you're not crossing it. But when you run faster in that direction, you would need to raise this intrinsic frequency to push that farther away so that you don't cross it. And that's exactly what happens in the rat. The frequency of theta increases with running speed.
But you have to do it in all your oscillators.
That's right, you do. Okay. And that's but when you look at the LFP or theta in many places, you see exactly that the frequency of the theta increases with running speed. And so this also brings in another point, which is that this intrinsic frequency, wait a minute.
I see what you're saying.
This intrinsic frequency may not be constant, and if it's not, the Fourier spectrum of theta may not be, you know, a very narrow peak, and how much it's free to vary may give us less rhythmicity in our autoparallelograms, for example, that Nockham showed recently in the back. Question, yes.
So following Peter's question, just to make us a bit less confused, are you going to propose that these are not grid cells and the grid cells are reading out the activity?
Yes, the grid cells are the readout of this code. Maybe that's a better answer for you. The job of the grid cells is to detect synchrony among these oscillators and read this code out. They are the readout of the code, not the storage container, as opposed to these attractor map models in which you're proposing that the spatially tuned neurons are actually the container in which the spatial code is stored.
Does it occur to you that the readout itself is a process that has to be taken care of?
Sure, absolutely. And we're going to talk about that. I mean, because there's a lot of other, so you have to address that as a cost. Yes, absolutely.
I mean, I'm thoroughly confused. All the grid cells need to know is velocity.
What do you mean? All the grid cells encode position.
Yeah, position, right? Yeah. So, you know, that's moving around and basically thinking somewhere. If, let's say, we have a tractor model, these grid cells basically, in order to move around properly, all they need to know is velocity. They need to know three numbers.
Well, wait. They have to know velocity, but then they also have to integrate that velocity. There has to be an actual. There's a predicate here, not just a noun.
Have to be able to integrate velocity, right?
Right. So the question. So, if in order to be integrating velocity, they have to be hooked together in very intricately detailed ways to perform a neural integration operation.
So this is all about more efficient neural integration?
Yes.
Okay.
Basically.
And what about the data that Lisa showed, where the, in a knockout animal, the LFP theta frequency dependence on speed was gone, and grid cells were okay?
Well, so again, an interesting prediction there, and I was actually going to ask her this, is that if you lose that that speed dependence of LFP frequency, you would expect the small grids to suffer first because their x-intercepts are closest to zero. So I would expect that in that case, your small grids might disintegrate, but the rest would still be okay because their x-intercepts are still way out here, if that makes sense. So that's a potential prediction. It would be interesting to know if that happened. And she shows that the grid sizes actually do increase in that same condition, which could potentially help to offset the effect.
What is small versus large?
Well, for the purpose of this argument, small is small enough that we can get across, that the intercept is closer to zero than the maximum running speed of the animal so that we can actually cross this sometime.
But the slope maps to grid scale.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So this is just a sort of talk about why this is a more efficient path integrator. So this was an example of a, still sticking in this sort of one-dimensional case. This is a ring attractor model from Song and Wang, 2005. This is a model of the head direction, angular path integration by head direction cells, which is, this is a spiking model that was based on prior work by, for example, Ketchin Zhang and others, showing how you have to wire together a ring attractor like this to perform accurate path integration. And in this model, they essentially implement a ring consisting of three different layers of neurons, one excitatory layer in the middle and two inhibitory layers. And essentially, the balance of drive onto the inhibitory layers controls the rate of rotation of the bumps. So equal drive onto both rings gives you a stationary bump. You alter the symmetry of the drive in one direction, the bump moves in one direction. Alter the symmetry of the drive in the other direction, the bump moves in the other direction. And the degree of asymmetry determines the rate of bump shift. And this is just showing, you know, their simulations of head direction cells and angular velocity with this network. So we have recently sort of created a modified version of this network in which the bump only moves in one direction. And when you make that modification, you don't have to add things, you take them away. You only need two layers of neurons, and as opposed to the eight weight vectors that you have in this network, you only need three here. Now, Sarah's point about performance may come up here. It's an important question of whether or not the accuracy of the path integrator is still the same. There's probably going to be a cost in performance to making this modification. One issue that this raises, so it's the performance threshold that we need to meet is the performance threshold that the path integrator has to meet in order to do its job. And as we've discussed a little bit from Nockham's talk and others, the preponderance of evidence suggests that path integration isn't all that accurate to begin with. It's not so great. So it doesn't seem like, I don't want to offend anybody by talking about natural selection or evolution too much, but the natural selection has gone in for the Mercedes-Benz path integrator. Otherwise, we would be better at it, right? The function of path integration may not be to tell us so much where we are, but where we're not. That is to put continuity into the code so that we know that there's some common sense constraints so that we basically never make teleportation errors so that we know that we're not supposed to, that we can't travel from Santa Barbara to New York City in half a second.
You can get continuity without path integration, right? If I only use, you know, visual inputs, let's say the view-based models like Gershner, you know, the retinal input, and I now move 10 centimeters, then the retinal input will change a little bit. I move 1 meter, it'll change more. So I can get continuity from sensory inputs without any path integration.
That's true. You could get continuity, but that your spatial code would then be depending entirely upon the continuity of the visual representation for its own continuity, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Huh? Yeah, it's inherited from the continuity of your sensory input.
Right. And so then you would have to have continuity. Every modality that you use to inform you about spatial position would have to have its own continuity built into it.
It's inherited. What Nakam said, if it's inherited from your sensory input, then why do you have to then build it at later stages? It's inherited.
Most people think path integration is useful for periods of time when you have momentary gaps in your sensory input.
Sensory what input is, yeah, is not constant.
Like when you have
lights.
I mean, I would get, Edvard made the point during his talk that grid cells.
While I'm blinking, my body still knows where I'm moving or not. I mean, this
yes, no, but if you're using these internal motion signals.
You guys, the notion of there is a
the internal motion signals do not give you location. That's the point. You have to integrate them.
There's certainly no visual stimulus in the world that repeats itself on a hexagonal lattice. So we can infer from that perhaps there is some more abstract representation of space that is not tied to any particular sensory cue. So this is just showing that we can use this ring oscillator circuit to function as one of the velocity-controlled oscillators that Neil has formally described with this VCO frequency equation. We can get linear changes in the oscillation frequency of this bump with linear changes in the excitatory drive onto the network. The conclusion then, or the initial argument that I want to make for potentially why you would use a synchronization code rather than a population code to build your path integrator for spatial coding is that it just costs less. It uses fewer neurons, fewer synapses, and for that reason, it might be preferred.
Okay.
Yes.
Get absent meta. Don't you need to know these references phase?
No, you do not, because the reference is an alignment, not a phase. There is a reference alignment, but there is no reference phase in this code.
But if you choose one of
I can show you.
If you choose one of the rings to arbitrarily be your baseline, it's much easier to think about.
Yeah, but I mean, you need to know the phase of the
Peter, if you're encoding the differences, you decode from the differences.
Yeah. So I mean, again, the equation for decoding position is identical for both codes. It's just that the reference phase is replaced by a reference alignment between two phases.
That reference alignment can be just like that bike. That bike can be anything. That alignment can be. You have to know what it is ahead of time in order to decode.
Well, that's true of this as well. There's no.
Yeah, exactly. We both have this problem. So these things are meant to oscillators, right? If you take the one of these oscillators and shift it without telling somebody. You can change your decoding position, right?
Right. So let's think about it this way. Okay.
You start up in exactly the right phase.
It's probably easy to imagine that, like, if I step into a novel environment and have to reset my path integrator in this code, I need to put my bump at the right spot in the network, right? Here, I need to align the phases. I need to set the phase alignment. I have to reset the phases of an oscillator.
Phase alignment is important. You got to get it right or it's not going to work.
Right. But there's no difference between doing that here and doing that here. The problem is essentially of the same nature. It doesn't.
Patty, if a monkey is moving in the environment, and Elizabeth thought that every time there's a saccade, then the phase of theta resets.
Right.
Would the animal be teleported every saccade? Teleported in space every saccade?
Well, it could well be that every time there's a saccade, there's new visual information that actually induces a phase reset of the path integrator based on the new information that's present. I mean, the moments that you would want these phase resets to occur are precisely the moment that new information about your position has become available.
But in her saccade at 4 hertz, so they would be teleported 4 times a second?
But in her thing, that it was supposedly tracking eye movement. It was an eye movement
position. Yeah, I was saying, I'm thinking now, let's assume that
a saccade is a teleportation.
Space, you'll still see a reset of theta every saccade. What would that mean for path integration, according
well,
to this model?
Well, or if you, it would mean that when saccades occur, there's an abrupt change in the visual scene that is probably bringing in fresh new sensory information that is triggering a reset of the path integrator, because as you have pointed out, the path integrator is lousy, and it needs to be reset frequently in order to remain accurate.
But also,
those are the perfect times to reset it, because new information is coming in at that moment. Yes?
Just to clarify, if I understood correctly, the phase reset, what you would need to do is not to reset, not precisely to reset the phases of all these oscillators, but to reset the relative phases.
That's right.
Phases.
Not the phases. Yeah. That,
the principle
that's
the overall phase could change from different.
Right. And that is what is very hard for people to conceptualize, but makes this a fundamentally different code from what everybody is right. used to thinking about. Okay, so wait, how did I get back there?
So that's
okay, so this is the readout part of it, I guess. So grid cells, yes, can read this code out by detecting synchrony among their inputs from these oscillators. And place cells can actually do the same. The only difference is that place cells then would be detecting synchrony among a larger set of oscillators, because synchrony among a small number of these oscillators is a frequent event that that occurs periodically every sort of beat cycle as the two oscillators move against each other. But frequency among a large number of oscillators is a very rare event that would only occur, let's say, at a single location in the environment. So I believe that all theta-modulated spatially tuned neurons in the rat are likely to be essentially reading out the path integrator at all times and checking whatever it is that they're also using to encode space, whether it's some other sensory information, what have you, against what the path integrator is telling them. And they do that by synthesizing a spatial envelope from the interference, and this is why this is, you know, basically an oscillatory interference model of the kind that Neil has proposed. They're synthesizing a spatial envelope from interference among these oscillatory inputs in order to check their current representation of position, derive it from both the path integrator and from other things. You can think of this as a sort of as potentially a sort of a Bayesian inference process where these neurons are trying to decode the posterior probability of where I am, and they're using a lot of prior information, one of which is the path integrator's phase alignment information that's coming in and will be synchronized at certain locations, plus other stuff that particular neuron may also be sensitive to, like visual cues in the environment, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the path integration part of it, the part of the evidence of your current position that comes from your past position, is encoded in this way. That's the idea. Does it make sense? Yes.
So your readout is not a readout of phase differences. You propose that the readout cell is just summing the amplitudes of this. It's a linear readout, just a linear superposition.
Well, it doesn't have to be linear. So like we saw in Jeff McGee's talk, a very nice sort of evidence that this process could become quite superlinear in this region where the synchrony starts to converge, right?
Right.
Jeff McGee's evidence really sort of implies that might be.
But in these simple examples, what have you done here?
These are just simple linear sums of these oscillators.
Just summation. Right?
Yeah, just to illustrate the concept.
Just summation of the oscillatory signals.
Right, and this is just the simplest illustration possible, but you can certainly use other kinds of combinatorics to get the envelopes. Okay. So, yes?
Do you have time for questions?
I think we do, because we're going, it's another 40 minutes or so, is that right?
Yeah.
So I think, we should be fine.
So suppose you have this neuronal sheet and network model, and the neurons are connected to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that...
You're talking about like spatially tuned neurons,
yes.
A sheet of placer grid cells.
A grid cell.
Okay.
And these neurons are connected, so there's a certain time gap between like how the neural signals are spread.
Mm-hmm.
So wouldn't that time gap... when there is an oscillatory underlying pattern, would lead to this phase differences, like this relative phase differences that you're talking about, right? Because based on what I understood, you're saying that these phases are measured relative to each other,
mm-hmm.
and these time differences could generate those relative phase differences.
I'm not sure what you mean by time differences, but I think maybe if you can hold that question until I share I will look at some models of connectivity between grid and place cells. I'm going to shortly here switch to the experimental predictions and evidence for whether this is going on or not, and then I think that will come back up with you. So before going into the experimental evidence part, I have to sort of explain how this translates into two dimensions, because we've been using the simple example of a linear track to discuss this so far. So to discuss how it goes into two dimensions, I think it's easiest to start with the population code, the grid code, and then we'll talk and then we'll look at the synchronization code. So let's say here's our plain old population code where the bump sits still when the rat sits still, the bump goes this way when the rat goes that way, the bump goes this way when the rat goes this way. That's a single ring attractor model of a rat's position on a linear track. One way of expanding this into two dimensions, which for example is proposed in this paper here, is to just make two ring attractors, and now one of these rings can encode the rat's position along, say, this vector, and the other along this vector. So now the spatial frequency that we previously used for our slope becomes a two-dimensional spatial frequency, and we're essentially now having each ring is encoding position on a sort of a sinusoidal gradient oriented.
And what determines this angle that you call theta m?
It would be that there would be the driving input to this ring would essentially be measuring the animal's velocity in this allocentric direction. We're just assuming that. I'm not gonna go into how that would happen. That's kind of what Michael Hassema was talking about in his talk about the coding for allocentric movement direction, and we can discuss that more later if you want. Okay, so the same idea now, if we're gonna do this with the synchronization vector code, except again, we have to wrap our heads around the fact that we're talking about the phase difference between two rings and not one. So we'll say that instead of having two rings, we have three, because again, the dimensions of the coding space are always one less than the number of rings, so to encode two dimensions, we now need three rings instead of two. And we're gonna say that this ring has a frequency that is non-zero when the rat is sitting still, but that frequency then increases with the animal's movement velocity along this vector, this one along this vector, this one along this vector. And so this is a VCO configuration that has been explored in some other papers and models, for example, by Neil and Mike Asimo, as well as ours. And in this configuration, the phase difference between this ring's bump and this ring's bump, these two bumps will shift against one another as a function of the rat's position along a vector that is the difference vector between the directions in which these two velocities are modulated. Good? So each pair of rings encodes the rat's position, again, because the dimensions of the coding space are phase differences between pairs of oscillators. Each pair of rings encodes the rat's position along a vector which is the difference vector between the directions along which the ring's velocities are modulated. Yes?
You know that you get oscillatory interference model, right?
Yeah.
The last 6 to 7 minutes was basically sort of putting that on strong theoretical rails.
Well, not just on strong theoretical rails, but also proposing a specific implementation for it. This is not quite the same as these dendritic oscillator models.
That actually wasn't my question.
Okay, okay.
So, a while ago you said, look, the reason I do this is because really all the grid cells, you know all the grid cells have to integrate velocity, mm-hmm. So integration is hard. Mm-hmm. So you replace it with this system, which also has to integrate, right? Because the frequency is proportional to velocity,
yes.
And it's phase, you have to integrate, so again you have to integrate.
It's, yeah, integration, you're not getting rid of the integration problem.
So why not, I mean, so we're still integrating, so we have a simple integration scheme, complicated integration scheme.
An integration scheme that achieves the level of performance that may be necessary for the system to work at a cost of fewer neurons and synapses than trying to do it in a population coding network.
Yeah. Sorry. Sarah, don't stop me.
Why not?
You're coming with this efficiency argument.
Yeah.
We just had lunch the other day, and you were saying that you agree that path integration is very lousy.
That's right.
And depends. So, in terms of evolution, nothing has converged. It's not a very efficient system. And I'm not sure how, if a system is not efficient, how are you talking about the most efficient code in terms of some cost that you think is relevant?
You know, path integration is lousy, you're right. And I live in Bel Air but never get invited to fancy parties. So I drive a 12-year-old Honda, not a Mercedes, because I don't need a Mercedes. Likewise, path integration does not have to be that good. So the system that the brain uses to do it is not a vastly intricate, expensive, amazingly accurate, perfect path integrator that would cost all kinds of resources in order to build. It's a much simpler system. It's the cheapest system that path integration can be done with.
Let me try to explain it.
Okay.
I've lost many of my emails due to my advanced age. And you started out by setting up this constraint capacity, continuity, and cost.
Yes.
And then at some point you said that the real purpose of path integration is not to know where you are, but where you are not. So it seems to me that from the fact that this kind of changes completely all the reasoning about cost efficiency, if the real purpose is just to say where you are not, it's a completely different kind of space. And
well,
now, this may have been a kind of boutade.
Yeah.
But now, in response to Yasser, you're saying something similar. You're saying, you know, I'm building an argument based on efficiency, but then in the end,
It's not clear what you are requiring the system to do.
Well, no, that's right. But so the argument, if you're going to make an argument based on efficiency, one of the questions that you have to deal with is how efficient does the system have to, or how, what level of performance do you need from the system in order for it to do the job that it's required to do, right? And so any arguments about efficiency, you're going to have to say, well, I'm only going to invest as many resources as I need in order to get to the required level of performance, and I'm not going to invest any more resources than that. Does that make sense? And the required level of performance does not seem to be so great. So why?
But all of this, so for a given level of performance, you can do it with more neurons or fewer neurons. We haven't actually got to the point where you say what the level of performance is yet anyway. So maybe the experimenters want to actually see the evidence that this is how it happens in the brain rather than the theoretical.
And that's probably, I think we should continue this discussion, as we come back to the theory afterwards.
So, perhaps it's, and I think that's exactly what you said. If I put aside your first few transparencies, so let's leave aside for a moment the philosophical discussion about evolution and cost and efficiency and this and that. So essentially, when you start with a ring, you divide it into several rings. You show that the advantage of creating that kind of code, and you essentially translated that into a temporal domain. So I don't see why we cannot explore the mathematical formulation of a model like that, and what are the implications of this model?
Oh, that I'd love to see.
Good.
So
you cannot confuse intermingle arguing the motivation with arguing the math of the model. You might dislike the motivation, but there is still a model, and I would like to understand the implications of this model. And then you can we can go back to the motivation and ask whether the motivation was justified or not, and whether evolution has converged. Yes, it has converged. Norway is the epitome of evolution. so now let's go wrong. I mean, it's a technical talk. There is a lot of technical things that I would like to understand without all the time going back to whether evolution has converged and whether this is optimal or suboptimal, or whether the task requires optimal or suboptimal. It was really proposed as a motivation, so please let's leave it aside for 5 minutes.
But let me also say that, you know, I do appreciate this line of inquiry because, you know...
But you asked for it because the way you started...
Right, and that's right. I know. I may have put the cart before the horse a little bit, but that's in part because we've dealt a lot of... These questions are already sort of alive and well in the field, and so I felt the need to discuss them at first, but maybe it's better. I think that they're important questions, but we'll deal with them at the end rather than in the middle.
Are you planning to talk about the noisiness of the theta oscillation?
It may come up. Why?
Because I wanted to ask, first of all, in terms of your model, the way you implemented so far, your oscillators may receive Poisson inputs, but they themselves are not noisy intrinsically,
exactly.
Right?
There's certainly going to be noise.
Beta cells is going to come on to you.
So my question is, as far as I understand, one of the strong motivation here is to connect this to a theta oscillation and imagine that the average rate or angular frequency at which these oscillators the periodicity is related to theta.
Yeah.
Right? Now, we know theta is a very noisy and not signal. It's not coherent in time, so you would have to have some mechanism that locks this noisiness in all of these oscillators.
Yes, exactly right. The noise has to be coupled, and that at the end I'll come to is what I actually sort of believe. I believe that that is essentially what grid cells are. Is a big part of what they're for is to do that job.
The end is approaching.
Okay. In that case, let's keep going. So we've got a half an hour left. So let's keep going. Okay. So. You know, the population coding is very non-controversial. Everybody, you know, has seen and believes in the existence of spatially tuned neurons that can store population code. The synchronization code, I guess maybe one of the reasons why I felt the need to justify it before presenting evidence is because it's certainly, you know, not as well established that anything like this can or actually does go on in the brain. And so in order to test whether that's the case, we've been looking at two basically make or break essential predictions of this kind of a code. That if this is happening, if the synchronization coding is going on in the brain, then two things absolutely must be true. First of all, there must be some theta oscillators, assuming that theta oscillators are the substrate for storing these phases. There must be some theta oscillators whose frequency varies with velocity in accordance with this VCO frequency law that Neil has outlined in his models. Essentially, that the frequency is going to be proportional to the dot product of the animal's running speed with some preferred vector that that particular oscillator encodes position, or in this case, velocity along, and that its frequency will be modulated around some potentially noisy and fluctuating baseline. But all of those baselines have to be coupled and locked together across oscillators. And then the second prediction is that if we could record from two of these oscillators, their alignment with one another, the phase difference between them, should vary with the rat's position along a specific vector.
Plus some offset,
right? Well, that's the reference
delta
alignment.
X.
That's right.
Delta X.
No, delta X is different position.
Yeah. You're right. Plus some offset. This is a translational phase, but here we're just going to be concerned with the fact that the frequency of the burst frequency of one of these oscillators would vary as the cosine of direction when speed is held fixed, and the phase offset between a pair of these oscillators would vary as the cosine of position along some particular preferred vector.
Capital omega p is independent of ET, otherwise they have problems.
Capital omega t is, yes, it's independent of VT, and it's, well, no, it's not necessarily independent, but it has to be dependent in the same way for all oscillators. This omega t has to be common. Yeah, it has to be common to all oscillators. But this thing can be noisy, this can do anything it wants as long as it's doing the same thing for all oscillators.
It should depend on direction.
It could depend on direction, too. That's actually not true. It can depend on direction. It can depend on anything as long as it depends on it in the same way for all oscillators.
If omega t is omega naught minus v dot v, is the amazing direction term. So it can't be completely dependent on v.
Wait, say that again.
If omega t was minus dn vt, does it depend on each oscillator because dn labels the oscillator.
That should be omega sub n.
No, it has to be.
No, it has to be not omega sub n. That's the point. It has to be
okay.
That's the hard part.
N is labeling. So we have a bunch of rings. Let's think about it as the ring.
Okay.
How can we measure this?
Say it again.
Well, he's going to get onto that.
But different oscillators have the same.
That last equation.
Yeah. So we're going to talk. Well, that's what we're going to look at. Actually, that's what we're going to look at.
So your last equation, if it's true, answers the point about noise.
Right.
Shows that however noisy they are, they still code a position.
Right, but my question is, how do you mechanistically make
that? Let's go for it.
That's the very end after the data. So what we do in these experiments that we're going to do, I'm going to talk about now, is we implant rats with a large tetrode array, and we're recording from 32 tetrodes at a time, and we're targeting structures along the ascending theta pathway that project up into the cortex, and I only have Neil Septim here, but the theta rhythm that synchronizes all these structures in hippocampus and internal cortex comes up through the mammillary bodies, which project then to the medial septum, and also through some of the thalamic nuclei up into these cortical structures, and we can talk a little bit more about this later on about the details of this prediction, but we sort of are of the view that these synchronization-coded path integration networks are largely subcortical, that they are down in the sort of the brainstem and midbrain regions that get velocity information from the motor system, and then they send these velocity-modulated oscillations up into the cortex, where they're then read out by the synchrony detector, which are the cortical neurons, essentially. clearly, theta frequency should be in some way modulated by running speed, and it appears that it is. And this is just a couple of example data slides, and we've seen this all week, so I won't dwell on it too much. But this prediction that the theta frequency should depend upon the animal's movement direction, which comes from this equation, is what we set out to test in this data that's published that I'll talk about briefly before getting on to the unpublished stuff. So, yes.
Ted, once again, so earlier I asked the theta frequency, and you said, oh, it's not the LFP frequency, it's
right.
The cell frequency.
That's right.
But you're now once again referring to the frequency of LFP.
Right. So that's, what I'm saying is that I'm sort of showing that that's another point that maybe I should make.
Is that
the existing evidence isn't necessarily relevant to this prediction because it comes from LFP, although unit burst frequencies also do vary with
speed.
But
it's all separate, right?
But you're right. So, and that's actually a point that I want to keep clear.
Because the data showing the LFP frequency change, does not change its speed, and you dismiss it.
Right, there's and that's an important point, which is that this model does not really make any strong predictions about what the LFP does at all, because it does not assume the LFP to be a substrate for encoding these oscillations. It's just it's a global average of something where, depending on where your electrode is, it's probably arising from this, but who knows exactly how. The prediction is that if you could record from one of these theta cells in one of these rings and measure its burst frequency, then with speed held fixed, its burst frequency should vary with the cosine of the rat's movement direction around some preferred vector. That's what that equation predicts. Does that make sense? And so in order to do that, we went into these various structures and recorded the burst frequencies of theta cells.
Can you get back a question? I have a technical math question.
Yes.
So this has to be true for all n, right?
Yes.
So that means d1.vft equals d2.vft equals d3.vft.
No, omega, it should be omega, little omega n. He's just talking about the frequency of that ring.
Oh yeah, this should be a little omega n. I'm sorry.
There's, okay,
you could, I thought you were talking about this one. So yeah, you're right. That should be omega n, and I'm sorry. You're right, yes. That's, yes, correct. So thank you, I'll fix that. You're right. Okay, sorry. Other questions? Okay, so the design here, it's not very easy to make these measurements because measuring frequency, reconstructing burst frequency from spike trains accurately enough to test these predictions is not a simple matter. So what we've done is create an experimental paradigm that will basically that will be used for all the experiments I'm talking about, where the rat runs around for as long as possible. In this case, it's 118 minutes, but we go up to 3 hours a lot of the time. They run around for a long, long, long time in a cylinder, and we record from a theta cell, and as I'll show you later, from pairs of theta cells. And what we do is then take the animal's trajectory and split it up into episodes during which the animal is running in different directions. And so we'll take spikes that were generated during movement in different directions. And we then we use a resampling procedure to normalize the movement speed in all directions. So because it's quite possible for that large omega t to vary with running speed, and that makes, and if the animal's movement speed in directions is not the same, that will screw up the analysis. So we essentially do a procedure that allows us to hold speed constant and analyze only with burst frequencies dependent on running direction. And then we can plot an autocorrelogram of the movement speed in all these different directions. I'm sorry, of the spike train in all these different directions, and then take a power spectrum of that spike train and see that the frequency does in fact seem to shift in different directions. And if we plot how that shift is related to movement direction, we often get something that is somewhat cosine looking. And so this is
Definitely a question.
Yes.
Why did you pick rectangular coordinates?
For rectangular coordinates.
Well, why did you pick cylindrical coordinates? Particularly since the animals, when they first get into a cage, it's sort of Galani's measurement.
Oh no, there's a. You mean around chamber?
Yeah.
Oh, there's a reason for that, because if the animal is in a chamber that has any flat walls, that strongly biases the movement directions that it samples, and we want uniform sampling of all movement directions. Does that make sense? If there's a square box, then he's going to very rarely sample directions that are not parallel to one of those walls. And that's much less often. So it creates a bias in the behavioral sampling that we want to avoid. You know what I'm saying? Okay.
This is for one cell.
This is for one cell, yes. And so
this
is for a lot of cells.
What's that, Paris?
Say again?
Paris?
That's the next experiment. That's the unpublished data that I'll show you in a minute. So this was an experiment where we simply recorded as many single units as we could in a lot of these complement thalamus, and you know, just see that in many cases there is a p less than 0.05 fit to the cosine function for movement direction.
And how much does it change in frequency?
It varies, but So that's a good point. So I took that slide out, but so.
And then the previous one, you could see it.
Yeah, yeah.
Just go to the previous.
Yeah, yeah. That's an example, right? So it's on the order of 0.3, 0.4 hertz in each direction around the baseline. 0.5 total. It's a small change. And you can translate that. The amplitude of this shift translates into a grid spacing. If you were to form a grid cell from interference among these oscillators, what would the spacing be? And the range of grid spacing that's predicted from the modulation depth that we see is 30 centimeters to 200 centimeters. So it's very close to what you'd expect for the...
And how much was the jitter in theta at each place within the bursting itself? Because it's a pretty broad spectrum at each point, right?
Meaning this.
Yeah, there it's a pretty broad spectrum. It's like 7.6.
Right, well again, so this is why it's, you know, in order to get enough data, enough spikes to create an autocorrelogram that you can actually take a meaningful power spectrum of, that's why we have to run very long sessions here. It's difficult, it's challenging. And beta cells, you have to find your nice high rate beta cells.
Do you think it's just a question of duration of data? Like theta cells have pretty high rates, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you could just split your data into two, go backwards.
Yeah.
You need to control for speed.
One sec. Yeah, it just split the data into two.
Mm-hmm.
Does the width of your power spectrum get worse? If you simply split the data into two, and I guarantee you it will not. So high, you can get pretty good sampling already.
Well, you start to, the more data, the more you downsample this, then you start to get a lot of high frequency noise in there.
Factor of two.
Yeah, yeah.
So if the amount of data is a problem, factor of two should give you a pretty significant drop in the width of correlation.
So the amount, the amount of data that we did actually, so we did the duration of the session and the mean firing rate of the cell. Can be used to calculate how much time you would need to sample in order to see the signal if it were present. And we actually did that calculation and did not include in the analysis cells that did not fire enough or were not recorded for long enough that even if the signal was there, we wouldn't see it. So we incorporated, I think, what you're talking about into the analysis because we were able to predict that if the signal was present, then in these cells, we ought to be able to see it. And those are the ones that we analyzed. Does that make sense?
But even within these cells, you'll have certain very high rate cells.
Yeah.
And there'll be some whose rates will be half the highest rate cells.
Yeah.
So
those don't have to be recorded for as long.
So the
session duration threshold for admission was different in those, would be different in those two cases because you don't need to.
So you can put all those parameters.
So what I find interesting is that most of these waveforms look like interneuron waveforms.
Which they are.
So could it be possible that these are interneurons that are coupled to head direction cells? And in the places where you have a change in frequency, there is some sort of phenomenon analogous to phase succession happening in these.
Well, so let me, these theoretical ideas are all good and will be useful to discuss as we move along. But I think I would like to get through the rest of the data, especially when people are starting to have to leave before we get into those details. So this is a version of a graph that Neil showed in his talk as well, which is just showing that when we average over all cells, we see, on average, it's about a 0.3 hertz deflection peak to peak in the rate. But this is over all cells. And again, when you look at the distribution of grid spacings that's predicted by these numbers, you see a distribution that's in line with what the rat actually shows, which is like 30 centimeters to 200.
You are actually not correcting for the amplitude along the y-axis. In that.
Yeah, that's where you get your prediction of spacing from, is the amplitude. So, quickly, this is just to show that we were able in this experiment to do some experiments where we recorded a head direction cell simultaneously with one of these cosine 2 theta cells, and this is across four sessions that were all like 2 hours long. So there's your cosine tuning function of this theta cell. During the first session, we rotate the cue card 90 degrees. The cosine tuning function rotates 90 degrees along with the head direction cell. We go back to the original cue card rotation location. The cosine tuning function goes back. We rotate the other direction. The cosine tuning function is just the other direction. So it seems to be anchored to the orientation of the spatial code as we would expect that it should be. So just in time for Edvard and Malcolm to leave, now here's the new data. So all that data is published, and that was, you know, experimental test of whether or not burst frequency varied as the cosine of movement velocity, as the theory seems to predict. The much harder experiment that we've been working on is to compare whether the phase alignment between pairs of theta cells is going to now shift with position as a cosine of position. And this is harder because you have to record pairs of cells to do the analysis. But basically the prediction is this, that if there's some preferred orientation in the environment along which if the rat changes its position, the burst frequencies of two theta cells that are in different rings will shift against one another as a function of the animal's position. And it should not matter, and this is important, which direction the rat is traveling along that vector. The phase difference should depend upon position in space, not upon distance traveled through a place field or in a given direction along a given vector. And if the animal is going in the other direction at some particular location, then at any given position along this axis, the burst frequency should stay, the burst phase should basically not change as the animal moves perpendicular to that. And what you can see then is that the phase alignment between a pair of simultaneously recorded theta cells is predicted to change as the cosine of the rat's position along a certain vector here and here, which are just opposite orientations of the same vector, and not perpendicular to that here and here. So far, so good? So some kind of evidence for something like this, and this is LFP data, of course, so it may be irrelevant anyway, but has been seen with the phase precession of place cell spikes against the LFP and also theta cell spikes against the LFP, which is essentially the evidence from these folks, and also stuff, a lot of stuff from the Busaki lab shows that distance traveled through the place field is the best predictor of the phase alignment between the LFP and the spikes, and that's sort of what you would expect, except that in two dimensions, what we're predicting here is that the phase alignment between the two theta oscillators depends upon position, not upon distance through the field, and a number of studies that have looked at this, including one that just came out from Neil's group, I think, in the Philosophical Transactions volume, but also by this Huxford et al. Paper, have looked at this and basically found that if you look at phase precession of place cell spikes against the LFP, they always precess as a function of distance traveled through the field. They do not encode position in a direction-independent manner, and that is not what the model predicts. So that prediction of the model remains unverified, and that's what we're trying to do here, is see if we can verify it by looking at pairs of theta cells rather than LFP versus place cell spike trains. So we're going into lots of the different areas that contain theta cells, including hippocampus, medial septum, mammillary bodies, various thalamic nuclei, and so on and so forth. And this is the sample of cells that we had at the time of our neuroscience poster a while back. It's gone up a bit since then, but I don't have slides of it yet. We had exactly 200 theta cells at that point. Now I'd say we probably got more like 260 or something. And this is the where those 200 theta cells were recorded from. So a lot of them, half of them exactly, were recorded in hippocampus, 76 in septum, and then various other areas comprise sort of a minority of the recording. So one thing that's kind of interesting that pops out here is that when we do a plot a distribution of the theta frequency of the cells that we classify as theta cells because they have strong rhythmic bursting between, say, 6 and 12 hertz, there is this interesting little sort of bimodal distribution. I'm not going to talk too much about this because that's not the point of the talk, but This is the autocorrelogram of theta cells that we recorded, and the black line shows when the rat is sitting still, the green when they're moving slowly, and the blue when they're moving more quickly. And you can see that the theta rhythmicity greatly increases during movement, as theta rhythmicity generally does. There's also these other cells, many of these are in the thalamus, but some of them are also in mammalian bodies and medial septum, that burst, and we've got simultaneous recordings of these at about 3 hertz higher. And we've kind of some ideas about what might be going on with that, but it's not the point of my talk. And then there's other cells that burst rhythmically during stillness, and these are like basically spindle rhythm kinds of cells when the animal is sort of nodding off. But the cells that I'm going to be talking about are all going to be of this type, the 7 hertz classic movement-related theta kind of cells that we're going to be analyzing pairs of.
And that's the same frequency regardless of how fast he's running?
This one is
This one doesn't show in the autoparallelogram. It's a little hard to see.
It looks
pretty close.
It's a little higher frequency.
It's a little bit higher, yeah.
Okay.
It's a little hard to see. This is more dramatic in some slopes than others, which is to be expected because they're supposed to have different slopes. Now, from these 200 theta cells, we have recorded 392 unique pairs of theta cells. So on a good day, we'll be recording 6, 7, 8, sometimes even 10 or 11 of these cells at the same time on a really good day. And that gives us many pairs of cells that we can look at to see if they're shifting phase against one another. And this is just a distribution of the numbers of pairs. So we have 136 pairs where both cells are in the septum. We have 29 pairs where one cell is in the hippocampus and the other in the septum, and so on. So you see that this is just the distribution of pairings that we have. So I'm going to show you data from an example session where we're recording four theta cells at a time. One of them was sort of down near the bottom of the dentate gyrus here, and the others were at various locations within the medial and lateral septal area. And this is a correlogram matrix for those cells. So this is not four cells, it's four recording sites, but we have six cells from these four recording sites. And in this matrix, we're correlating each cell with the other cell, so the diagonal is the autocorrelogram for each cell, its correlation with itself, and off diagonal we're seeing the cross-correlogram between the cells. And a cell like this, for example, that sort of has a slightly weaker rhythmicity and its cross-correlogram with the other cells looks a little funny. This is kind of what you might expect to see if the frequency of the cell is not exactly constant, if it's shifting with velocity or something like this, because, so the modulation depth is not quite as strong. And also if its phase relationship with the other cells is not constant. So this is the kind of thing that we like to see to sort of hope suggest that maybe something is going on here. So this is not the point of what I'm talking about. Okay, so to analyze the way that the phase relationship between these cells depends upon the animal's position, we're going to plot correlograms, this heat plot of autocorrelograms. So, cross correlograms. So what we're showing here is that we're taking data from when the rat occupied positions along this vector, different positions along this vector. So if the rat was anywhere here, that corresponds to this column. If that was anywhere here, that corresponds to this column. Anywhere here, that's corresponds to this column. And then we're going to do the same thing, rotate this vector. So we're essentially looking at how the cross-correlogram varies with position along these different vectors of different orientation. Does that make sense? And so what we're seeing here is an example of two cells that have exactly the same phase offset with one another at all times. No slope, flat. What you're seeing here is an example of a pair of cells where, for example, at disorientation, you seem to see that their position shifts. I mean, their phase offset depends on the position. And as we rotate that vector, the slope seems to get a bit shallower. And if we plot that slope as a function of the orientation in which the animal is moving, we get something that looks a lot like a cosine function. So when I plot these orientation plots, I show two graphs. One is this blue graph, which comes from data averaged in both opposing directions averaged together. And the red line is separating out movement along in the vector along one direction from that on the other, so that you can see that it's independent of what direction the animal is moving. It's not distance through the field. The fact that this thing flips over like this means that it is encoding position, not distance through the field.
How do you go from there to there?
From here to here?
Yeah.
This is actually just the first. I'm only showing the first six of these. So the slope of this phase difference here is the y-axis, the slope in degrees per meter, and the angle of the position vector along which we are looking for the phase shift is the x-axis. So what this means, this cosine means, is essentially that something like this is happening. As I change position along a particular oriented vector, the slope or the phase relationship between my two oscillators is changing as the cosine of the angle between this preferred orientation and the orientation that I'm studying. Does that make sense?
A little, but I'm still stuck at fitting for example, last one into whatever. And where do you fit a line there?
So what's the
or even the previous one, I don't know. Hard time seeing where to fit.
The way that this slope analysis is being done is that I am taking each column of this parallelogram and then shifting the next column against it and finding out what shift does it give me the best, the strongest parallelogram. And that's how I'm estimating the slope, by doing that with all the pairs and then finding out and then estimating the slope from here. In this case, because there is not much of a slope structure when you're at the perpendicular orientation, when you average all of those best shifts together, you get basically a zero slope. Because
that's the same as a zero slope in the bottom row?
It's similar to the same. Well, so it's not quite the same as a zero slope in the bottom row, because here the animals, and this is depends a bit on how the animal samples the environment too, but here we're averaging over many different positions along which this phase does actually vary, whereas here it's just always constant. Does that make sense? So there's a difference between these two cases. But how big a difference it actually is depends quite a bit on how the animal samples the environment, and that's something that we're actually needing to deal with. Because as you'll see, some of the cells that have a slope, you know, don't always look like this there, and I think that's because if the animal samples along this dimension more in a location of a particular phase alignment than another, it's going to show up, you know, more as like a band here as there of zero slope, and it's variable that you see there depending on the animal behavior. We have to probably need to control for that a little bit. But this particular cell that is shifting phase against this other cell, as a function of position, does so against all the other cells, not just against that one that we're comparing. But most of the other cells don't do it against each other. So it appears that basically one way to interpret this data is that in this recording, these cells are all acting as if they're in the same ring and therefore have a pretty constant phase offset against each other. But this one cell is in a different ring from the others and shifts against them all. Does that make sense? So these are just some other examples of cells that appear to do this. And so, as I said, you know, this smearing gets a little bit, the smearing is more or less in different cells. But we have a, running out of time here. We have a reasonable criterion for whether a cell is showing this effect, and right now it's pretty preliminary because all these data analyses are preliminary. But it's basically a criterion that involves the least squared errors fit to a cosine function of how that slope changes the position, combined with an amplitude criterion. If the slope is not greater than a certain amount, we consider that not to really be existent. And what we find is that the probability of seeing this effect is quite different depending on what pairs of cells you're looking at. So we actually started doing this analysis with pairs of cells recorded from the hippocampus, and we were never seeing its effect, and it was very disappointing. But now that we have all this data, we see that it actually very rarely shows up in pairs of theta cells recorded from the hippocampus itself. There's, in this case, only 12% of the cells are meeting this criterion, and I think those 12% are the ones that, you know, more barely meet it than actually robustly meet it. Whereas if you record pairs of cells in the theta septum, you've got more like a 30% chance. Or and the sampling, the number of samples is kind of low for some of these other pairings, so it's kind of difficult to say how good of an estimate those numbers actually are. But we have a lot of pairs in both the hippocampus, and septum. And we do have quite a big difference between the incidence of this effect in those two kinds of pairings. So this suggests to us that
why would you see, you had very few pairs that involved the thalamus, however there you see very strong results.
Yeah, that's right. So of the pairs that we do have in thalamus, well, sir, this is three, so that just means that 33% is one out of three. So the sampling is kind of low in some of those other pairings.
So you don't put much into it.
You can't put too much into it now. I mean, 50% out of 18 isn't too bad for thalamus versus hippocampus, but we're expanding this data set all the time. This is about 3 months old, so we'll have to go back. So another thing that's a little bit interesting is that if we look at the data from all of our animals, We have six rats so far in the study, and one of them was our sort of star rat so far that has given us 48 pairs that shift against one another. And if you look at a distribution of the orientation along which those shifting pairs shift, it looks somewhat perhaps trimodal. I'm not going to make a big strong claim about that, but this is not dissimilar from what you might expect if grid cells of a similar orientation are all being synthesized from these oscillators downstream. You would expect a sort of a trilateral symmetry in the vectors along which this orientation is shifting, phase coding of position of the current. So I think I'm kind of out of time, right? Should I stop here?
You want to stop and at least have some questions.
Okay. So I think instead of running on to part three, and maybe as questions come up, I can answer them by using some of the part three slides.
In the meantime, let's first play. Thank Ted.
Yes. So these cross parallelograms.
Yes.
You need to take sort of segments of data, like a whole second in which it's just stayed in this narrow strip of the environment.
Yes.
And what is the time limit that you put in?
So I think what I ended up doing here was taking all pairs of spikes, well, the speed filter first, so take speed filter the spike trains of both cells, and then if a pair of spikes occurs within the time window of the parallelogram, then I just calculate what is the animal's average position during those two spikes, and I put it in that bin. Okay. Does that make sense? That's the way it's done. Other questions?
So on this plot, I guess I shared a little bit of my concern. It's not obvious how you get the slope out of it. Is there any way to assign statistical significance, or to put error bars on those?
Yeah, no, I think
that show on the right to get a feeling for how much we should trust this.
Yeah, no, this is again, it's preliminary unpublished data, and I'm very open to suggestions on how to do this. But there is a point, and I was arguing about this with Ketchin at lunch the other day, that I would like to make, which is that in doing this analysis and looking how the phase shifts with position, it's really important to, the only model that I want in the analysis is a model of the hypothesis that I'm trying to test. So the hypothesis only makes a prediction about the slope here. It makes no prediction about the absolute phase, because like Peter's point was
that.
But
I understand that. Given that there is a slope, you won't understand how it varies.
Yes.
You want to see this cosine.
Yes.
But given that there is a slope, tested against the hypothesis that there is no slope in that model. So, in some of these patterns, it's hard to say that there is.
So slope. the way the slope is being measured right now, and this is I'm open.
This is what I meant by having error bars on the slope.
on those averages. Of the offsets that matter.
There's a trick, I don't know, comes from the particle tracking world.
Yeah.
Because you're sort of looking at space versus time.
Mm-hmm.
So if it was completely flat, right, it'd be separable.
Yeah.
So you could take the singular value decomposition of the data, and then you could just keep on shearing it. And then finally, at some rotation, right, some shear, it'll go perfectly flat, and you get the highest separability, which is like how much is in the first component when you stack the eigenvalues in rank order versus the sum over all of them. So that gives you that can be turned into a confidence.
Okay, so that's something maybe I should chat with some after the talk. I should digest that a little better because I didn't quite follow.
Sorry.
That's okay.
But to tell, have you tried this?
That makes a lot of sense to
me.
Because you can always delay at the same time.
Yeah.
You're
averaging over everything.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's a great question. And I have not done that for this pair. I've done it for some pairs and gotten encouraging results. But I'm again, this is preliminary. But yeah, so Ketchin's point, which is important, is that I showed earlier that we can see this sort of cosine velocity tuning. And if you know the cosine velocity tuning for a pair of cells, you should be able to predict the orientation of the position vector along which they shift phase. And it will be very important to verify that to make sure that this is real. And that would be a very helpful check as well, is that that the orientation here is not random, but the orientation of the cosine peak is not random, but predictable from the velocity analysis, if that makes sense. Yes?
So I got a little lost in details, but what do you show there, velocity control oscillator?
Well, that's the main result. This result is the velocity controlled oscillator result, which is just that the frequency, the burst frequency varies with movement direction. But this result gets more to Barak's question about whether or not they really are phase coupled to one another. Because if this really is happening, and I'm sympathetic to the request for better analysis and data and evidence for it, but if this really is happening, it couldn't possibly happen unless not only are they velocity controlled, but their phases are coupled, yes. And so that their synchrony, their phase relationship does in fact control encode position, even though they're not spatially tuned. That's what we would like to be able to infer.
You could also be able to get some handle on the amount of noise.
The phase noise?
How noisy these things are from the data, is that possible?
Well, what kind of noise?
Cycle-to-cycle variability, you have a change in time, all sorts of...
Cycle-to-cycle variability of the phase between the oscillators.
Yeah, between the oscillators and themselves, is that possible?
I don't know. I mean, it's hard enough to...
I can suggest the same thing I was saying. You split your data into smaller segments and see how stable this relationship is between themselves.
It's just like, I think we're working like at the threshold of observational sampling as it is, because we're running 3-hour sessions here to even be able to pull this. I feel like, you know, we're it's like particle physics, right? You need like a really big accelerator with lots of energy to see these tiny little effects, and that's
but
what we're doing.
But then I would argue, you know, if it's such a tiny effect, how is the brain going to use it?
Because the brain, unlike us, is not limited to seeing two cells at a time.
But then each one is going to have a completely different relationship, and they're going to look at only one pair versus not the other pair.
No.
The stuff that Jeff McGee showed yesterday, you know, is the ideal mechanism for detecting this synchrony if it exists, you know, if it really is. But of course, even that might not work if there's only two cells feeding a single CA window. So I think that's the answer, is that it's really a population level. Anyway.
So I lost a lot of the details as well. Okay. A very humble experiment. There's something fundamental that I'm not getting here. Okay. So my understanding is that there's some kind of displacement signal that offsets these oscillators.
Yes.
And that offset is a kind of a code position. And then the grid cells or whatever can read that out.
Yes.
And they turn that into
a rate code.
So why have you not just put into this model the thing that you're getting out of it?
But it gets in velocity, not position.
But velocity is change of position of time.
So
it just feels to me like the explanatory power seems.
Well, so to summarize, what you just said is correct. So the idea is that spatially tuned neurons encode position, you know, as patterns of firing rate, as you know, population vectors of neural firing rates. But this synchronization code, these neurons, these theta cells, they basically fire essentially the same rate all the time. There's no firing rate code whatsoever. Yes, it's the phase offsets between the bursting that is encoding information, and just as in this case, you would need changes in the population vector to evolve in time as in a velocity-dependent way. In this case, you need changes in phase alignments to evolve in a velocity-dependent way. So it's kind of...
You've got two different ways of encoding the same quantity.
Yes.
But what does that bind?
What does that bind? So that's what I was trying... That's the cart that I was trying to put before the horse with all that stuff at the beginning. But the idea is that you have two symbiotic codes for space. One, the synchronization code, which is stored by a bunch of rhythmically bursting oscillators that are synchronized with one another in a way that tells you where you are. And over here, reading that code out, you have a bunch of synchrony detectors that read out and generate a population code from these ring oscillators. And I think this is very much the structure of the model, that the Bush and Burgess model that Neil talked about on Wednesday. The function of each of these units is somewhat different. So subcortical theta cells, I would argue, are the reason why they are in the circuit is because they have a job to do, which is
path integration and imbuing the code with continuity, knowing that, you know, if I was here a moment ago and I moved a little bit, then I'm here now. Whereas these cells, which are always reading out the path integration signal so that they are basing their estimate of position on the available evidence that's available from past position, are also reading in information from other sources, landmarks, so forth, and this is, I think, also consistent with Neil's model, and then also constantly feeding back to reset the phases of these things when necessary, which is what Peter's point of this sort of question was about, like, when a landmark comes along and tells this place cell that you know you, that we're very sure that we're in this particular place, that place cell feeds back, resets the oscillators, and loads that in to the synchronization code. So the different jobs that the spatial coding system has to do, path integration, recognizing landmarks, maintaining stability of the code with respect to the environment, and also internal consistency with itself across scale, is a job that these population coding neurons are primarily responsible for. Whereas using the evidence of prior location to inform current location, i.e. path integration, is a job that these cells do. And they're constantly in communication with one another so that the code, you know, remains stably aligned with itself. And it's a way you build sort of two separate coding systems so that you can integrate all of the prior evidence about your current location in a way that is best suited to each form of evidence, if that makes sense.
How is this synchronous oscillator supposed to control inhibition within the population representation?
Over here? Well, so inhibition and excitation in some ways become differ one another just by a phase shift, essentially, in these synchrony detection models. If I'm detecting synchrony among two excitatory inputs and I make one of them inhibitory, now synchrony just becomes anti-phase from what it was before. So it's inhibition and excitation.
So you just passively align to excitation.
Yeah, inhibition and excitation sort of acquire different meaning in some sense in these models. But
Kind of.
Wrap it up. Yeah.
Really wrap it up.
Okay. So we have some time to discuss things.
Can you go back once?
Sure.
Look at it while you wrap it up.
Yes. Okay. Okay. We can chat while after we wrap it up. Yes.
Great.
Okay. Thanks, everybody.